This morning, I would like to focus our attention on a parable, and it is in Luke chapter 18, verses 1 through 8, the parable of the persistent widow. And we will be looking at this parable in some detail this morning, but I would like to begin just by reading it. So you can either follow along with me on the screen, or you can open up your Bibles. We'll be in Luke chapter 18, beginning in verse 1. And he told them a parable to the effect that they ought always to pray and not lose heart. He said, in a certain city there was a judge who neither feared God nor respected man. And there was a widow in that city who kept coming to him and saying, give me justice against my adversary. For a while he refused. But afterward he said to himself, though I neither fear God nor respect man, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will give her justice so that she will not beat me down by her continual coming. And the Lord said, hear what the unrighteous judge says. And will not God give justice to his elect who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long over them? I tell you, he will give justice to them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? This is a parable, and a parable is often defined as an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. And I think that that's a pretty good, succinct way to understand what a parable is. Literally, the word parable comes from a Greek word that means to place beside or to cast alongside. And so the idea is that when Jesus tells a parable, he takes some spiritual reality, something that is maybe more nebulous or difficult for us to comprehend and understand, and he places it alongside a story that would be very relatable. He puts that profound spiritual truth in normal everyday terms that we can relate to. And the effect then is that parables use seemingly ordinary stories to make profound truths emerge and reveal themselves to us. And the way that they usually accomplish that is by way of comparison. You know, Jesus tells a story and it becomes quite clear who the characters in the story are meant to represent, and there are parallels between the events of the parable and the relationship that we have with God or our identity or responsibility in some way. And this story is a bit of a strange parable because this parable makes its point not mainly by means of comparison, but mainly by means of contrast. Usually the parables show us something similar about God, but this actually shows us something very different about him. Now, I just want to show you the way these verses are organized. The story itself is told in verses 2 through 5. That really is the meat of the parable. And then the conclusion is drawn in verses 6 through the beginning of verse 8. And then the whole thing is framed by the application, which is stated in verse 1, and then asked as a question at the end of verse 8. And so what I want to do this morning is very simple. I just want to look at these three sections of the text: the story, the conclusion, and the application. So let's look in some detail at the story, verses 2 through 5. We learn a couple of very important things about this judge in verse 2. Jesus introduces a judge in this town or this province, and he says in verse 2 that he neither feared God nor respected man. I think it's interesting, too, that the judge recognizes this about himself. When we get down to verse 4, he says it out loud, though I neither fear God nor respect man. So despite this judge's obvious flaws, at least he's aware of them. But the judge doesn't fear God, and he doesn't fear man. We probably all know people like that. People who live without any kind of sense of responsibility to the Creator. No awareness of any kind of judgment, or at least no sense of responsibility. If somebody doesn't fear God, he has no regard for God's ways, no respect for God's nature or God's glory, no desire to submit to him or to honor him at all. And because he has no fear of consequence or fear of judgment, there's no sense of accountability. And so he just lives however he wants to live. Now, what the Bible will tell us is that that is the definition of foolishness, to live that way. Proverbs 14 and verse 12 says that there is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way to death. When we make the choice to just do whatever we think is right, to just live in whatever way that we desire to live, that's foolishness because we can't trust ourselves. We don't have the wisdom to work that out. And so Proverbs also tells us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. That's Proverbs 9 and verse 10. And so the only way to have wisdom or knowledge is to choose the fear of the Lord. In Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 29, wisdom is personified like a woman. And it pictures her out in the streets crying out for anybody that will listen, for anybody that will pay attention. And what she says in Proverbs 1:29 is that our responsibility is to choose the fear of the Lord. And so here is a judge who has chosen not to fear the Lord. And as a result, as a consequence, he is foolish. But the second thing we learn about this judge is that he not only has no fear of God, he also has no respect for man. I'm not sure exactly what that means. Maybe it's one of two things. It could mean that he has no regard for earthly authority either. You know, a lot of times when people have no regard for heavenly authority, no regard for God's authority, then they also have no regard for earthly authority, no regard for governments or powers that God has put in place here. If you look over in Romans chapter 13, you see that connection. Romans chapter 13 and verse 1, here the Apostle Paul writes to Christians living in the Roman Empire, and he says, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment." And, you know, I guess this just makes sense, that if you have no respect for the Creator of heaven and earth, if you have no fear of the sovereign God who controls all things, then you wouldn't really have much respect for government authorities that God has put in place. And so what Paul says here to these Christians is, look, if you really do believe that God is the one who is in control, then you have a responsibility to submit to earthly authorities. But maybe another idea about what's going on with this judge is that maybe he's also lacking in compassion. This word respect in verse 2 is the same word that's used in Matthew chapter 21 and verse 37. If you go over to Matthew chapter 21, Jesus tells another parable, and it's known as the parable of the tenants. And the word is used in verse 37 when it says, "They will respect my son." But let's just read the context. Let's read verses 33 through 39. Matthew 21 and verse 33. "Hear another parable. There was a master of a house who planted a vineyard and put a fence around it and dug a wine press in it and built a tower and leased it to tenants and went into another country. When the season for fruit drew near, he sent his servants to the tenants to get his fruit. And the tenants took his servants and beat one, killed another, and stoned another. Again, he sent other servants, more than the first, and they did the same to them. Finally, he sent his son to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But when the tenants saw the son, they said to themselves, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and have his inheritance." And they took him and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Now, you see the same kind of idea here about respect, that it's because the tenants of the vineyard have no respect for the master of the vineyard that they also have no respect for the son. But you might also notice that there's just a real lack of compassion here, you know? Like, how heartless do you have to be? How greedy do you have to be? How stone cold do you have to be to just mercilessly kill an innocent son who comes to the vineyard? There's a real heart problem here. They lacked basic compassion. It also reminds me of the principle in 1 John chapter 4. In 1 John chapter 4 and in verse 20, John writes, "If anyone says, 'I love God,' and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have from him: whoever loves God must also love his brother." And so people who don't love God will have a hard time loving people who are made in God's image. And so this judge doesn't fear God. He doesn't respect man. He has no regard for God's authority or for earthly authority. He has no love for God and no compassion for people. That's the judge in the parable. Now enter the widow in verse 3. We learn a couple of things about the widow here. Number one, she's desperate. And number two, she's persistent. She's desperate and she's persistent. You know, widows are consistently acknowledged in Scripture for their dependence and for their helplessness. Over and over again, God shows a special concern for people like that. And typically, the widows are put into the same category as the immigrants or the sojourners, as well as the fatherless and the orphans. And in ancient times, widows would have been in a very vulnerable position. A widow would be somebody who found herself in a position of real helplessness. Because without a husband to protect her and to provide for her, her options would have been very limited. She wouldn't have had the rights and the privileges that men enjoyed. She wouldn't have had the means to provide for herself or to defend herself like men would have had. And so if she was suddenly without her husband, she would be without all of those barriers that would protect her. She would be without all of those means of her well-being being taken care of. And what we're told here is that this widow is in a particularly vulnerable position. It says in verse 3 that she is seeking justice against her adversary. Now, we're not told exactly what is happening or what the problem is, but apparently there's somebody who has wronged or taken advantage of her in some way. And so she's desperate. And because she's desperate, she's seeking help from the one who is in authority. She is going to this judge, asking him to make the wrong right. Whatever it is that's happened to her, she can't defend herself. She needs him to defend her. And the second thing that we notice about her is that not only is she desperate, but she's persistent. She doesn't only ask once or twice. She asks repeatedly. Verse 3, you see the language. It says, "There was a widow in that city who kept coming to him." In verse 4, Jesus says, "For a while he refused." But after some length of time, finally, the judge is annoyed enough to respond. And we have the expression that the squeaky wheel gets the grease. That seems to be what happens here. You know, in verse 4, he acknowledges, like we said, I neither fear God nor respect man. But in verse 5, he says, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will give her justice so that she will not beat me down by her continual coming. The Greek word that's translated beat me down is a very interesting word. Literally, it means to strike under the eye. And so the expression that she's using, or that the judge is using, is something like this. Like, I'm going to give this widow what she wants before she gives me a black eye. That's his perspective. And so notice that he is moved to respond, that he is moved to grant her request, but he's not moved by any sense of justice. He's not moved by any kind of righteous motivation. He's not moved by any kind of compassion. It's a self-serving, self-centered annoyance that finally leads him to say, I'm just going to get her out of my hair. Now here's the conclusion. Verse 6. And the Lord said, hear what the unrighteous judge says. Jesus calls this judge unrighteous. And hopefully we know and trust that our God is a righteous God. Jesus focuses our attention on the way that this unrighteous judge acts because everything about him is meant to be a contrast to God himself. Everything about the unrighteous judge in this story is a contrast to the righteous God that we serve. The judge doesn't fear God in verse 2, even acknowledges that he doesn't fear God in verse 4. That means that his ways are ungodly. People who fear God will honor him with their actions. People who fear God will demonstrate that they have learned to think and act in ways that are consistent with his nature. If this judge doesn't fear God, then his thoughts, his actions, his words are meant to show us everything that God is not. God doesn't merely fear God. He is God. He is totally faithful to his own nature. He is totally consistent with himself. And everything about him is good and righteous. God hasn't only learned wisdom. He is wise. He is the source of it. His actions are totally consistent with the goodness of his character all the time. And I've got to say, the more that you think about that, the more you meditate on that truth about God, the more comforting it is. The more reassuring it is that God never changes. Who else is there like that? You know, the extent to which we are good and reliable people is the extent to which we have learned to fear God and to trust him and to obey him. But guess what? None of us are perfect. And if you are hoping that I will never let you down, at some point you're probably going to be disappointed. But God never disappoints those who put their trust in him. The fancy word for this is the immutability of God. This morning in class, we talked about a theological word. Here's another one. Immutability. We talk about God being immutable. That is the quality of God that says he never changes. He's always the same. His nature never varies in any way. You remember in Genesis chapter 3 where God appeared to Moses in the burning bush? And Moses wants to know what his name is. God reveals himself by saying, I am who I am. I am who I am. That's at the very core of who God is. He's immutable. He never changes. He is the ever-present one, the ever-consistent one, the one who was and who is to come, from eternity to eternity, one who never fails, never lets his people down. The way that James says it in James chapter 1 and verse 17 is he says that he is the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. In contrast to something like the moon, that goes through various phases, goes through various shadows and changes and turnings, God is always the same. You know, throughout the period of a month, you go out there and you look at the moon, and sometimes it's a big, huge circle in the sky, and sometimes it's just a big toenail up there. God's not like that. Whenever you look to him, he is always the same. He is always consistent. He never fails to be who he is. And so, this judge doesn't fear God. He's not righteous, but God himself is righteous and consistently righteous. But the other thing that we noticed about the judge in the parable is that he doesn't respect man either. God sure seems to care about man, doesn't he? He is compassionate towards people. There's not a person on earth who God doesn't care about. There's not a person on earth who God is not concerned for. There's not a person on earth who God doesn't love. And that's because there's not a person on earth who has not been made in the image of God. He cares about his creation. He loves them, and he desires good for them. What does Jesus say about God in John 3:16? For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. God surely does respect man. He does have a concern for man. He has a desire for man. He has compassion for man, unlike the attitudes of this judge. But the other, a final contrast that I want to make between this judge and God is that God has a special concern for his elect. You notice that the judge in the story has no special relationship with the widow. In verse 5, when she comes to him, he just calls her this widow. It seems like he doesn't even know her name. You know, here's this woman who keeps coming to me and she keeps asking for stuff. And, you know, there's no kind of relationship. There's no kind of an ongoing relationship at all. But what a contrast it is between what Jesus points out about our relationship with God. In verse 7, he says, and will not God give justice to his elect who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long over them? I tell you, he will give justice to them speedily. What Jesus is pointing out is that our relationship with God is totally different than the relationship this widow had with the judge. She comes before God as a nameless beggar. She comes before the judge as a nameless beggar. She comes before the judge as somebody who is just desperately appealing her case. But we come before God as his children. What does Romans 8 and verse 15 say? For you did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption as sons, by whom we cry, Abba, Father. The same way that Jesus himself could talk to God is the way that we can talk to God. Because the Son of God has died and removed the barrier of sin and given us the opportunity to draw close to God, we come before him as sons ourselves. Jesus taught his disciples to address God as our Father in heaven. He said in Matthew chapter 6, verses 7 and 8, and when you pray, Do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think they will be heard for their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. In Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 16, it says, "Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need." You see, everything about the judge and the widow's relationship to him contrast God and our relationship to him. And so here's the application. If this widow could be persistent with a judge like this, then why shouldn't we be persistent with a God like ours? This woman had no reason to expect her request for justice to be satisfied. But we have every reason to believe that God will grant ours. One day, he will make every wrong right. And that's the thing that Jesus wants to focus the minds of his hearers on. At the end of verse 8, he says, at the beginning of verse 8, he says, "I tell you, he will give justice to them speedily." Now, the problem with that is that it doesn't always feel speedily to us. A lot of times we feel like this widow, don't we? We come to God and we have things that are on our hearts and we have things on our minds and we are begging and we are pleading and it seems like we're not getting any kind of answer. Or at least the answer that we're getting is not the answer we want or possibly just not on the time frame that we would prefer. And if you've ever felt like that, you ought to know that you're in good company. Because anybody who has ever had a real relationship with God has struggled in that relationship, has had to strive with wanting things and not understanding why God is not responding in ways that you might expect. From our perspective, it might not feel speedy. From our perspective, it might feel like we're languishing. I think about Psalm 13. Psalm 13 is a psalm that begins on this note. You know, a lot of times the psalms begin with some kind of affirmation of praise, and then maybe the psalmist will voice a complaint. But Psalm 13 in verse 1 begins like this. "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me?" I appreciate that in that psalm, the psalmist has a relationship with God where he can say what he feels. You know, even the saints that are slain in heaven, in Revelation chapter 6 and verse 10, they are pictured as being underneath the altar, and they're saying, "O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" Jesus affirms that God will give justice to his elect speedily, but from our perspective, it doesn't always feel very speedy. But the Lord always has a purpose. You know, in 2 Peter chapter 3, Peter is talking about how there are people that are questioning God's timeline about judgment and eternity. And he says in verse 9, "The Lord is not slow to fulfill his promise, as some count slowness." We might not always understand why God is not responding as quickly as we wish that he would. But what we know about God's character assures us of two different things. Number one is that whatever the reason for God's delay is, we can know that it's not because he doesn't care about us. And number two, we can know it's not because he's going to let us down. No matter what we're going through, no matter how hard it is, no matter how difficult it is to understand, no matter how much we feel like we're languishing like the psalmist in Psalm 13, saying, "How long are you going to forget me forever?" we know for certain that God cares about us and he will not let us down. God will satisfy our souls. And on the grand scale of eternity, any amount of waiting will become nothing more than an infinitesimally minuscule blip in time. And so, we ought always to pray and not lose heart. That's the point. That if the widow could be persistent with a judge like this, then why can't we be persistent with a God like ours? If she could be persistent with a judge who didn't fear God, didn't respect man, who didn't even know her name, then why wouldn't we be persistent with a God who is consistently righteous, who loves us, and who tells us we can come before him as his children? The text ends with this question. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? I want to suggest that that question really is a restatement of the application in verse 1. This is one of those rare parables where Jesus actually tells us explicitly, this is the point of it. And at the very beginning, Luke tells us this. But he told them a parable to the effect that they ought always to pray and not lose heart. Why should we do that? Well, the reason why is because prayer sustains our faith. The moment that we stop praying is the moment that we start losing heart. You know, this widow could have been discouraged. She could have been discouraged by the lack of response she was getting. She could have just gotten weary of coming to this judge over and over again. She could have just gotten tired of it and gotten to the point where she just quit asking. But it was the asking that kept her hope alive. It was the asking that maintained her faith. As long as she was asking, there was still a hope within her that the judge would grant the request. Prayer works that way for us. That the moment we stop asking is the moment we start losing heart. The moment that we stop coming to God is the moment that we stop trusting him. And so prayer sustains our faith. I appreciate about this widow that she was in a desperate situation and she knew it. You know, she knew that she had nowhere else to turn to, no one else to go to. This judge was the one who had the power in that city to make some difference in her life. This judge was the only one who could possibly alleviate her problem and give justice to her situation. And so even though it seemed like she wasn't being heard, she refused to stop making her request because where else would she turn? Who else would she go to? It reminds me of Jacob in Genesis chapter 32. There's a very strange story in Genesis 32 where Jacob encounters a mysterious man in the middle of the night. And they end up having a wrestling match. And they wrestle all night long. And finally, the man is revealed to be God in some form. But at the end of the night, God says to Jacob, "Let me go, for the day has broken." And you know what Jacob says? He says, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And God was pleased with that kind of persistence. God was pleased with that kind of tenacity. He tells him, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." And there he blesses him. That's the kind of persistence that this widow has. That even if it seems like it's a losing battle, even if it seems like there's no end in sight, she says, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." It reminds me of Peter in John chapter 6. You know, in John chapter 6, there's this story where Jesus has given some hard teachings, and a lot of these crowds have left him and deserted him. And it says in John 6 and verse 66, after this, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. So Jesus said to the 12, do you want to go away as well? What a question. Imagine that you have been walking with Jesus and you've been sort of trying to piece together the truth and the wisdom of the things that he's saying. And admittedly, the 12 at this point seem to have a little bit of a shaky understanding of everything Jesus is about. And it gets really difficult. You know, you get to a point where it just seems like things aren't really making sense anymore. And you look around and you see all these people that are quitting. And Jesus looks at you and says, you could quit too. You could walk away. And look at Peter's reply in verse 68. Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. And we have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God. You see, the widow recognized that she had no one else to appeal to. The judge in her city was the only judge that there was. No one else had the power. No one else had the authority. He was the only one that she could turn to. And like the widow, Peter recognized that there was only one judge that he could appeal to as well. No one else has the power. No one else has the authority. There is no salvation in anyone else. And so he says to Jesus, no matter what it takes, no matter what it costs, no matter how long this path is, I'm not going anywhere. Because there's no one else I could turn to. You see, that's the kind of persistence that we need to have too. Because spiritually speaking, we're all widows. As much as the judge contrasts God in this parable, the widow is a comparison to us. Spiritually speaking, we are helpless. Spiritually speaking, we are defenseless. We are weak. All of us are in a desperate situation. But God has consistently and repeatedly identified himself as a God who widows can depend on. Psalm 68 and verse 5 calls him Father of the fatherless and Protector of widows is God in his holy habitation. In Jeremiah 49 and verse 11, God says, let your widows trust in me. So here's the point of the parable of the persistent widow. If the widow in this parable could maintain faith in a judge like hers, then we ought to maintain faith in a God like ours. Despite every reason to give up on the judge, she persisted. And God has given us every reason to trust in him. We ought always to pray and not lose heart, because we can put our faith in a God who loves us. There might be somebody here who realizes that you have been looking for justice in all the wrong places. And what Jesus assures us of is that God will grant justice speedily to his elect. To be somebody that is the elect, to be chosen by God, is actually something that you have a great deal of control in. Because the ones that are chosen by God are the ones that are humble enough to hear the message of the gospel, to receive it, and to obey it. And so you have the choice this morning. Who is it that you are turning to? Who is it that you are seeking salvation in? Where is your hope placed? And I want to encourage you to have the same kind of faith that the widow had, the same kind of faith that Jacob had, the same kind of faith that Peter had, to be able to look to Jesus and say, "To whom shall we turn? You have the words of eternal life." If you need to make your life right with God, if you want to come to God through his Son, Jesus Christ, and we can help you, we want to invite you to come to the front. Let us know while we stand together and sing this song.